Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills, accelerate your team's impact, and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
Been looking forward to doing this interview for a while because it's a fascinating subject. It is The Rejects, an alternative history of popular music. Imagine that you are in a band that is on the cusp of making it or just made it, and then artistic differences, you name it, you got it, you're out suddenly on your proverbial. It is the subject of a new book called The Rejects. It's by Jamie Collison. Delighted to say that Jamie joins us live from a glamorous location somewhere near LA, I would imagine. Jamie, where are you?
I am in Los Angeles, yeah, which is very glamorous, but I'm also in the garage, which makes it less glamorous, I think. So
it's a very LA garage. For people who can't see, he's got the T-Bird, he's got the convertible, the whole thing. It's something that color will come back, Jamie, I'm telling you now.
Yeah, I wish there was a T-Bird in here. Maybe one day.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, we all get these sort of rags to riches tales and, you know, bands who come up by their bootstraps and then make it big. And I've, you know, I'm forever talking to people about this. But this is fascinating because it some of these, like Pete Best, we know about, obviously, probably the most famous who got dropped by a band before they made it big. And Brian Jones, because we can argue the Stones had it big, but then they went sort of stratospheric in the 70s with some absolute, you know, before they released their, you know, the trilogy of superb albums. But there are others who, you know, surprisingly are told to go away and then crop up with other bands. So Bootsy Collins, of course, and Lemmy, and others, of course, it's much more tragic. So how did you put this all together then?
Well, I mean, the original idea for the book was inspired by Jason Everman, who's a sort of tiny piece of musical history, really. But he loomed very large for me because he was in Nirvana briefly, and Nirvana are basically my favorite band of all time. So I remember this figure, this small figure from Nirvana's history. He's actually on the front cover of Bleach. He's the guy with the long hair, but he didn't play on the album. But very crucially, he paid for the album's recording. And years later, I read that he'd not only been kicked out of Nirvana, but he was kicked out of Soundgarden too. But both times for being too moody. And, you know, you can imagine how moody you'd have to be to get kicked out of two extremely moody bands. But he went on to have this incredible career as an American Special Forces soldier, and he became a Green Beret, and then went on to do a philosophy degree at Columbia and became this kind of warrior philosopher figure, and he's now a very fulfilled character. And I found that completely fascinating, and then that led me to the idea of looking at lots of people who were thrown out of bands and what happened to them. And that was the origin.
Because I mean, there are various reasons that people get kicked out of bands, aren't there? I mean, there is the Pete Best who basically was told he wasn't good enough, or perhaps you don't fit in with the image, or perhaps you get a touch of the, should we call it the lifestyle, Jamie? And the lifestyle kind of takes over you.
Yeah. I mean, these themes really emerged, and obviously drugs and drink is a huge one. And, you know, there's a lot of that in the book, a lot of rock and roll stories. Unfortunately, those very often end in tragedy, obviously. Money is a big one. I think there's a lot of it boils down to royalty splits and how much people are being paid. And it's, you know, it can be a sort of festering thing in a band. And then, aesthetics, you know, you hinted at it just then. I think that's actually one of the biggest things in the book. And it is a crucial thing in music, sometimes depressingly so, that, you know, the way someone looks or just the way they fit into the overall picture. There's a great quote from Brian Epstein about when Ringo joined the Beatles, and he said, you know, it wasn't until then that the picture made sense. And unfortunately, it does boil down to that a lot. Jason Everman didn't really fit into Nirvana because he was more into kind of heavier music and the way he was moshing. You know, Kurt didn't like that. And there's this very tragic story about Kim Shattuck, who was briefly in the Pixies and carried out this stage dive in her hometown of Los Angeles when they played. And she was admonished by the manager straight after the show. He said, "Don't ever do that again." And she said, "Why not? For my own safety." And he said, no, because Pixies don't do that. And that really sort of shows how aesthetics are crucial to bands, and you know you can very easily lose your place for not looking right.
And just thinking about some of the great, I mean, I was just scanning down the list, and what I saw one just leapt out at me. Well, I mean, and first of all, I don't think we've got Alice Cooper in there, but he got rid of his whole band, didn't he? Because he decided he was going to become Alice Cooper, which is, and I've interviewed members of his band before, and they're still quite a sore subject 50 years later. But I've interviewed Woody Woodmansley, and I've finished Spiders from Mars, etc., and the huge Bowie book. And what he did to Mick Ronson was absolutely brutal.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fascinating story, isn't it? Because there were two firings of Mick Ronson. First of all, when Barry ended the Spiders from Mars, live at Hammersmith, and Mick Ronson was in on that, whereas the others weren't. And then there's a second real firing where he actually did cut Mick loose. And, I say at the beginning of the book that there's this Graham Greene quote that every artist has a splinter of ice in their heart. And, you know, that power to be able to observe things coldly. But I think it applies to musicians in the sense that many of them cut people loose who are quite close to them when they're no longer useful to them. And I think that really... That really applies to what Barry did to Mick Ronson. But more than that, the lack of royalties and the lack of writing splits, you know, this is a guy who's completely crucial to Barry's success and to arranging all these amazing string parts in Life on Mars and songs like that he really should have been earning from. And it's partly because Mick Ronson was almost pathologically not into representing himself. You know, he just didn't show any interest in that. But you know, they all should have known really that he should have been being paid for that. And so even if he was to be fired, he should have been much safer financially later in his life. That's another sad story, and also an example of how crucial somebody can be to actually making the music happen. You know, without Mick Ronson, those records simply don't happen, and Barry wouldn't have happened in the way that he did.
Well, yeah, and Barry then goes off and has his LA, not too far from you are, we get Thin White Duke and some very interesting times. But it goes to show as well, doesn't it, the fact that when you put a band together, it's normally either a group of mates or a group of people who can play music, and they're thrown together and they're doing it for the love of music. They're doing it because they want to be in a band, because they want... So business acumen and getting a slice of the royalties when you're 21 or 22 years old isn't at the forefront of your mind. I mean, yeah, Ronson's an incredibly nice guy, and so that's why he gets the proverbial, because he's not concentrated. He's not bothered with the music. He just wants... with the money, he just wants to make the music and be in a band and create stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, one of the best pieces of advice to a young band would be to split the money. You know, if you look at someone like U2, they famously split the money from day one. And I think including with their original manager who passed away, that's a very good way to keep a band together and to keep everybody motivated and involved and, you know, just bring it down to fairness. But yeah, you know, I say in the book that bands are often formed in youth. And then these firings can seem to be emblematic of an adult hardening, you know, sort of everyone growing up and becoming harder and crueler and tougher, and then ejecting people who started off as their childhood friends. So these stories are nearly always a tragedy. Although, of course, you know, some of these bands are just thrown together, and the way we perceive them as these very tight units can be a total myth. You know, quite often they're just disparate individuals who actually just have their own plans, want to do their own things. So looking at these rejects can tell us a lot about the myth of a band and how things actually work.
Well, if you look at the original sort of girl power band, the Supremes, for example, coming out of Motown, coming out of that factory, the brilliant things, and they were unlike anything else. And yet what happens it's Florence Ballard, isn't it? And that's Florence really, Ballard. Because they're so young and it's so manufactured and you've hit that height or whatever, and then you drop out and they go absolutely worldwide. And it's not like today where you probably have counselling and you sell your story and put out a solo album, Good Evening and Robbie Williams. You're left, you're absolutely dropped, and it all goes horrendously wrong for her.
I mean, I think that's the darkest. I mean, there are a lot of dark stories in the book, but I think that's probably the darkest, not least because, you know, I refer to this group of rejects as the ultra elite rejects, the band leaders themselves. And Florence did actually form the Supremes. She named the band, she got them together. And she had a great voice, but her voice was more of a gospel voice in a slightly lower register. And Berry Gordy, the Motown boss, considered Diana Ross's voice, which was higher, to be more of a pop voice and more commercial. And there's this idea that the relationship between Berry Gordy and Diana Ross led to Florence's downfall. But that's not strictly accurate. Unfortunately, Florence had this terrible tragedy in her life. She was taken to a high school dance by her brother, lost track of him, and was then raped at knife point by a future NBA player. And she understandably never recovered from that. You know, I think we were even less good at dealing with things like that in those days, obviously, as you implied. And there was alcoholism in her family. She turned, you know, she always struggled with drink. And Berry Gordy bullied her over her weight, which seems completely, you know, atrocious, especially by modern standards. She wasn't fat by any standard, but he kept telling her that she was overweight, and she started to react against that by pushing her stomach out on stage and drinking more. And yeah, I mean, she unfortunately led a very short life. She died at 32, I think, and you know, eventually she threw a drink in his face and was fired and spiraled down from there. But yeah, I think that's the most tragic story of the book. But it was nice to shine a light on her again and just her amazing talent and then the fact that she actually started the band.
And then you've got other bands like, you know, Destiny's Child. Now, the definition of sisterhood in the 90s and the noughties, you know, Beyonce goes on to become, you know, biggest star in the world, basically. But they're, and if you see sort of video of them in the, it must have been the early, I'm sorry, now I'm feeling very old, must have been the early 90s, and they're drilling and they're rehearsing and they're practicing. You know, they ain't Nirvana. You know, they've got stage moves that they are doing 12 hours a day, and yet there are members of Destiny's Child, even though they're practicing, who get, again, ceremoniously dumped.
Yeah, I think that's possibly the most brutal and sort of, you know, the blade coming down story in the book. It's Latavia Robeson and Latoya Luckett, early members of Destiny's Child. And yeah, I mean, you know, that band was drilled in a sort of military sense by Beyoncé's father and by Beyoncé, I think. You know, she was always a very ambitious person. And they started to question the money and Beyoncé's dad was managing them all. And they probably quite reasonably began to ask, you know, is this best for us, or is this all becoming about Beyoncé? And they made the crucial mistake of seeking separate management. And so the blade descended, but nobody told them. And they only realized they'd been fired when the video for Say My Name appeared on TV and they weren't in it. So you can imagine how, you know, how brutal and shocking that was. And I think it took both of them quite some time to recover from that. But yeah, that really illustrates that kind of cold, brutal, you know, you're out.
And yet there are those who get bunged out who then go on to have rather great careers. I'm just thinking, because Glenn Matlock's been around about it because of the recent Pistols thing, and he was, the recent punk revival, and he was chucked out of Pistols, wasn't he, early days, and Vicious came in.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, one of the greatest myths of musical firing. So, you know, the master publicist, Malcolm McLaren, famously, basically Matlock fell out with them and left. And when the NME asked Malcolm McLaren what had happened, he said, oh, you know, Glenn Matlock kept talking about the Beatles and Paul McCartney, and that's not right for the Pistols. And, you know, it's all about this kind of nihilistic punk thing. And then they got Sid Vicious in. It didn't work. And, you know, a couple of weeks later, he's back asking Glenn Matlock to join. And Glenn Matlock quite understandably refused to. And there's a second great myth about that, which was that Glenn Matlock was always washing his feet and the rest of the band didn't like it. But yeah, you know, he was, that's possibly one of the most famous myths, which didn't actually turn out to be true. And then you've got these people that go on to have these great secondary careers. You know, probably the ultimate one is Lemmy, really.
Yeah.
You know,
Well, I read White Line Fever during lockdown, and I wasn't very well, right. And it was a tonic and a half because it's just the ultimate, I mean, rock star book, isn't it? And him talking about Hawk, because wasn't he originally Hendrix's roadie, and then he sort of like joined the good ship Hawkwind.
That's right. Yeah. So he, you know, he devoted his life to rock and roll very early on. I mean, as you say, he's a totally irrepressible character. But his story doesn't really contain much darkness because he's just a sort of, he's just one of those guys that just kind of carries on happily. But yeah, he talked his way into Hawkwind. He picked the old bassist, I think, quit, but left his bass behind. And so Lemmy literally picked up the bass and started playing. And his presence became bigger and bigger in the band. He started to move to the front of the stage and became a bit more like a front man. And crucially, he'd invited in a drummer. There were two drummers in Hawkwind, and it got quite pompous. Lemmy referred to them as the drum empire. And he used to stand to the side of them, taking the mickey and saying rude things to them and telling them to hurry up. But one of them he'd actually invited into the band and later went on to sort of stab him in the back. But yeah, Lemmy was on different drugs to the rest of Hawkwind. And when they tried to cross from America into Canada, he was caught with some amphetamines, which were initially considered to be cocaine, and he was arrested and had this terrifying moment where he's about to go into a really serious jail and he's being given the delousing spray. And the band only bailed him out because they couldn't get anyone else in to play the gig in time. And he later found that out. And then after that gig, they fired him, and this drummer that he'd invited in voted for him to go. But the band leader himself, Dave Brock, loved Lemmy and he wanted him to stay. And he had the nicest things to say. I quote quite a lot of the band leaders who did the firings, and what he says about Lemmy is incredibly warm. You know, they were friends for life. But also, Lemmy's revenge, I think, is the greatest in the book. He flies back to the UK and sleeps with as many of the band's girlfriends as possible.
In true Lemmy style. I mean, you speak to the Hatchet guys, like I said, Dave Brock, etc. But they were always going to go on different paths because, you know, Hawkwind, psychedelic rock man, you know, 18-hour guitar solos, and Lemmy is there on different substances. And, of course, he's going to play three-minute thrash and be the godfather of modern stroke punk rock. But do people feel, I mean, is there remorse? Because, I mean, having read the Keith Richards book, Life, and that, I mean, they're like, well, Brian was starting to sort of discombobulate of his own free will and accord, and we couldn't have him with us. Same thing's happened with the lead guitarist, for example, with the Black Crowes, who spirals out of control. So is there some band leaders go, yeah, we're really sorry, but, you know, we couldn't, what we wanted wasn't what they could provide, sort of thing?
Yeah, I think there is remorse. I mean, actually, some of those quotes from Diana Ross about Florence, you know, she said some quite tough things about her that, you know, maybe I should have slapped her in the face and stuff like this. But later on, she sort of said that there's a great quote in the book that there was something inside her that was just pulling and, you know, that she couldn't handle. I think a lot of them do reflect more on that especially as they get older. I mean, the Stones also fired Ian Stewart, who was basically a classic example of aesthetics. You know, he had this big, broad chin. He looked a bit like a sort of movie star from the 30s and just didn't fit the picture. And Andrew Lew Goldham said, you know, he's got to go. He actually stayed with the band playing piano behind a curtain occasionally, and he became a road manager. And he was one of the only people that could speak, that could take the mickey out of them and say these, you know, hilarious quotes. And he died quite young, and both Mick and Keith speak very tenderly about him. And I think Keith even said, I don't know if it was Mick or Keith now, but one of them said that the band would never have got going if it wasn't for Ian.
I think it's so, Keith, because I think they all meet above a pub, aren't they? And he's playing Boogie Woogie Piano or something like that, and that he's like a constant presence, you know? And Bootsy Collins. You know, if you like your funk, and if you want to know where Flea gets his look and Mark King get their licks for, it's from Bootsy Collins. I mean, out there, to put it mildly, played with James, you know, the hardest working man in show business, and my goodness, the hardest taskmaster in show business. And James Brown says, you're too good, but you can't play in this band.
Yeah, well, this is my favourite stories in the book, because I love the way that Boosie looks back on it and realises what James was trying to do with him, which was, you know, it was almost the sort of writer's credo of show, don't tell. So he really took Boosie under his wing, and he showed him that he was calling all the radio stations personally and asking them to play his music. And when they were, you know, as you say, the hardest working man in show business, had a really tough band leader who really wanted his band to be very well drilled and really on the point. And so every time they played a great show, he would tell them that they played a bad show and vice versa. You know, and as young men, they didn't really understand what he was doing, and it seemed very unusual and probably quite cruel. And Boosie learned to cope with this by laughing, basically. It was the only, you know, the natural response, really. And eventually he took the laughing too far. He'd always promised James that he wouldn't ever take acid and then play a show. And, you know, eventually they're all starting to do a lot more drugs. And he takes acid, plays a show. His bass turns into a snake and it's a disaster. So straight after the show, he's called into the dressing room in front of James and his security and gets this brutal dressing down. And he just starts laughing. So, you know, falling on the floor laughing. And obviously that's incredibly disrespectful. And he gets instantly fired. But I love that his coping mechanism became the downfall. You know, he sort of laughed his way out of the band.
Absolutely. Now, there's a title that leaps. Everybody else has got their names after it, okay? And two have leapt out. Adam Ant, did he fire himself? Because I saw him in the mid-80s, and he, you know, about 86, live in concerts. But this is presumably he's being dropped from Adam Ant, he's fired. What's the Adam Ant story?
Well, so I say at the beginning of the book that I'm not going to stick too closely to the rules, because, you know, rules aren't very rock and roll, and we miss out on some great stories. But this is another great Malcolm McLaren story, basically. So Adam hires Malcolm McLaren to be his manager on an unusual arrangement. He basically pays him a cash fee rather than a percentage, which is how management normally works. And so Malcolm starts managing him, subjects him to hours and hours of lectures and philosophy about what the band should be. And then one day he just steals Adam's backing band and turns it into Bow Wow Wow, which is basically the band that he'd been sort of lecturing him about conceptually. And leaves him all alone, takes his backing band, starts Bow Wow Wow. But crucially, he leaves Adam with some musical inspirations and the pirate look, and gives him a really good kick up the bum by stealing his band. So, you know, I say in the book that in some ways he does the perfect job. He comes on briefly, teaches him something, gives him a kick up the bum, you know, gives him a new aesthetic. And but yeah, I just thought, you know, it's a typical Malcolm McLaren move, isn't it? To just nick
your band. And also, yeah, Bow Wow Wow Live in the Country sounds awfully like, and probably wouldn't be allowed these days, but there you go. And this is a great title: All the Musicians Kicked Out of Fleetwood Mac. Now, we're massive Fleetwood Mac fans. When I do my Saturday morning show, Meet with Flack is a huge part of that show. So tell me about this one, Jamie, because it made me laugh.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it just felt like this had to be in there, because the really funny thing about Fleetwood Mac and firings is that Mick Fleetwood, I think due to his own predilections, is a really tolerant band leader. You know, he doesn't really want to kick anybody out of the band ever. But, there's usually a really strong reason. So there's sad stories like Danny Kirwan, who is a genius guitar player and songwriter. He idolized Peter Green, but was a very different type of musician to Peter Green. He was meticulously rehearsed and wanted everything to be very well organized. Again, developed a drinking problem and went completely crazy backstage one night and smashed everything up, and he had to go. I think my favorite one is Bob Weston, who was this very, really handsome, very talented guitar player and writer. And Mick thought he'd solved all their lineup problems when he found Bob Weston. Yeah, I say in the book, he looks a bit like a 70s rock Michael Fassbender. He's kind of a really handsome guy. And they're on the road, everything's going brilliantly. And then it becomes clear that Bob is sleeping with Mick's wife. And
oops.
So they very gamely tried to carry on for a few nights. And, you know, obviously it was never going to work. And one morning, Bob wakes up, there's a knock at the door, and the entire road crew with all their scars and scowls are standing outside his door, and that's the end of him. And he says, you know, that was the most expensive affair I've ever had. It cost me a career, because he never, you know, nothing that great ever happened to him after that. And then, of course, the final one, really, Lindsey Buckingham, the other architect of Fleetwood Mac, and the person that was allowed, you know, Mick trusted to be allowed to be a key influence on Rumours, and then really the key architect of Tusk, which is, you know, an album that is now a very critically acclaimed Fleetwood album.
It is now, but at the time it was absolute, because everybody was waiting for the one after Rumours, weren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but it marks that transition into the sort of cocaine minimalism of the 80s. And, you know, I think Mick would have really not wanted to lose Lindsay, but it was eventually just a smirk that did it. He was standing behind Stevie Nicks at her Music Air's Person of the Year award, and they were all goofing around because she joked about speaking for too long, and he smirked, and she later saw that, and that was the final straw after sort of decades of fighting with each other and never really recovering from the fact that they'd been in a relationship. And she just said, I don't want to be on stage with him anymore. So, yeah, I mean, you know, for a band that's been going that long, they've obviously, there's quite a number of sackings. So I thought I'd put them all in one place.
Yeah, exactly. I thought it was a great song. And just also, there's a Sugar Babes one in there. And I just read it at the moment that there are currently, apparently, two Sugar Babes touring, because Heidi and the Maghrebi, the Moroccan girl, and then you've got Keisha, and my Sugar Babes, my girl pop mood is going to let me down, but you've got Keisha and
are currently
touring as but she got kicked out, didn't she, after the first single?
Yeah, so she I always remembered her because I think Overload is a really interesting single, and there's loads of really creative talent behind it that went on to write for Amy Winehouse, and you know, it sort of spoke of that kind of early noughties minimalism, and so I'd always remembered it, even though I was never really a sort of, you know, into that kind of pop sound. And I remembered that she had said that she'd been hounded out, I think largely by Keisha, and that, you know, it had really ruined everything for her, and that she would never forgive her, you know, that first bully in your life, I think she said. And she effectively, I think she walked out of a tour in Japan without telling them that she was leaving, but she considers herself to have been hounded out. But that story to me speaks volumes about the tenacity that you need to have a career in music, because after saying all of that and enduring all of that, she does eventually come back and they get back together. And, you know, they're out there touring again. They're back with their original manager, who there was also lots of fallout with. And, you know, if you want to be in music and have a career, you need that sort of tenacity almost above all else. And so that story really illustrates that.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because, I mean, rock bands tend to sort of swap members like they swap girlfriends, wives, or girlfriends and wives, or whatever. But the machinations behind girl bands and boy bands is brutal. It makes the Red Wedding look like a tea party, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's all about this. When something is that kind of, there's a bit of manufacturing in there or a lot of manufacturing in there, it is almost these brutal sorts of factory conditions, isn't it? It's like that piece is no longer working. We fashion a new one and quickly move on.
What do you hope that people will take, apart from it being quote-unquote a right rocking read? Because it's fabulous. And I'm amazed that, respect, sir, for putting it together, because it's absolutely crying out for a book. So what do you hope that people will take from it?
Well, I think that lesson of tenacity, but also I think in some ways it does explode the myth of the gang and the perfect lineup, which I really believed in before I wrote the book. I kind of thought that the original lineup's always best and it's always a tragedy when that breaks. But actually the book sort of showed me that anyone can be the right person for the job at a given time. And quite often it's an outsider or someone who's only briefly a part of the gang who makes something brilliant and sees how the piece of craft that's being made could be better or could be at its best. And that gives me tremendous hope, because it kind of means that, you know, at any point where we could all be the right person for a job. And that's quite an inspiring thing to think. But yeah, and tenacity, really. Someone like Jason Everman shows that every life can and should have several acts, and you know, that you can, that there's always something else out there.
Book is called The Rejects. It's by Jamie Collins, and you'll be able to order it via our own virtual bookstore. Jamie, if people want to find you online, where's the best place to find you?
Probably on Twitter, I'm at JR Collinson. So thank you very much for that.
No problem at all. The book is called The Rejects, an alternative history of popular music. It's by Jamie Collins. Jamie, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Thank you very much for having me on. This is brilliant.